If you have your Bible, would you open it to Daniel chapter 3? If you don't have a Bible, we have some on the back table. I pray you'd grab one of those, open it up, and follow along with us. If you don't own one, if you really don't have a Bible, please keep one of those. Make it your own. You can write in it today, put your name in it, all those good things, and take whatever notes you want to. We've been going through Daniel, and as I told you in the very beginning of this study, the book of Daniel has so much prophecy, just powerful prophecy. One after the other. A matter of fact, so much so that the critics have chosen this above all the books to really target in accordance to its authenticity because they want to discredit it. Because it really proclaims who God is and the level of the power that our God has to be able to see the beginning from the end, to look into the future and to reveal secrets. And so for that reason, this book is awesome. Because we can go back through and have our faith built up as we read and we see that God really does know everything. He sees everything. There's nothing that He is unaware of. But I also told you that when we got into the book of Daniel, there's another part that I really enjoy. That's the character of Daniel. The character of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or as we know them by their Jewish names, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. These men who say, I will stand for the Lord in a hostile environment. I will not bow down to any other than my God. And I will worship Him. Just like we sang, I will worship only You, Lord. And we sang in one of our songs, I will lay down my life for You. Those were lyrics that you and I sang today. These guys live this out. And they give us an opportunity to see it lived out. And it should do a few things for us. One, it should bolster our faith. It should cause us to say, I can do that. I can live for the Lord like that. I can choose to do that. And it should help us to see that they, when they put their trust in the Lord, never found themselves wanting more. He gave everything that they needed, always when they needed it. He was their supply, their lifeline, everything that was needed. What I also want to tell you is that although this story is more than 2,500 years old, the account that we're going to read today, a true account, a historical account, the applications that are found in this account, man, they still are just as much needed today as they were 2,500 years ago. And depending on where you live in the world, they might be more needed than in other places. But each Christian is going to come up to times when they encounter persecution. I hope so. If you're really a Christian and you're living bold and your desire is to not bury the treasure that the Lord gave you, but to share it with others that they might come into salvation, you will encounter opposition. You will encounter people who do not want to hear what you have to say. And that hostility is growing. Which is great, in my opinion, because I would much rather share the gospel with somebody who's hostile toward it because they're trying to get away from what they know to be true than somebody who's aloof and could care less. But that hostility is coming. That persecution is here in many places, and it has been through the ages. And that's really what this chapter is going to deal with. It's going to deal with persecution of the believer. Now, of course, you can transfer this into trials also. And many Bible teachers who have taught this passage have converted it pretty much to trials. Trials that you and I might go through in life. Difficult times and how God will show up and He will be there. And all of that is true. But don't minimize what the text is dealing with here. Its main focal piece here is on persecution of those who will dedicate themselves to God. Who will live for Him regardless of the cost of doing so. And as we've said on many different occasions, the world needs more who are willing to do that. Who would say, regardless of the outcome, I will not bow a knee to any other than my God. I will not move my heart, I will not move my feet in a direction that does not honor Him with all that I have. And that's what this text is going to show us today. But now with that, let's jump in, because last time I taught this, it was 8 pages worth of notes, so I had to boil this way down, so we don't have a lot of time. We're going to have to get in. There are lots of good truths in here. Daniel 3, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, this is the king of Babylon, made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and whose width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. I want to give you a clear understanding of this statue or this thing that he made. When it talks in cubits, let me convert that to feet for you. We're talking about 90 feet tall, about 9 feet wide. And what we understand is archaeologists have found the platform that they believe that this image was on, and it's another 20 foot tall. So overall, this is about 110 feet in height. And if you're a tree person around here, the biggest of our trees around this area, the very tallest, I would say, are about 110 to 120 feet tall. So if you go outside and you look up and you see those Douglas firs, the big ones out here, that's the height of this image that Nebuchadnezzar made. And it was overlaid with gold. It says it's of gold. It might have been pure gold, but gold's a kind of soft metal. It'd be hard to imagine that that would have the structure to hold itself. So it was probably another metal or wood or something overlaid with gold. Nonetheless, this thing was worth a fortune. So when you say, hey, how come we can only find the platform? It's because somebody else found the gold. It's worth a lot. It would have been worth a ton. So I'm sure it's been scavenged and it's gone at this time in history. Now for us, we read about the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in our last study in Daniel 2. And in that dream, Nebuchadnezzar sees this statue of a man, probably also very sizely from what we understand. And it was segmented in different metals. The head was made of gold, but the other segments were made of less precious metals as they went down all the way to the feet, which were of iron and clay. And what Daniel was able to tell Nebuchadnezzar after telling him his dream was each one of those kingdoms or those metals represented a different kingdom. But Nebuchadnezzar was that head of gold. And he said, your kingdom is an excellent kingdom given to you by God. He says, but after you, that next kingdom, which would be the Medo-Persians, would come in and your kingdom will come to an end. Now, after a little bit of time, Nebuchadnezzar did not apparently like this answer. At first, he was excited that Daniel had given him this interpretation, that he told him what this image was about. But here we're about 20 years further away from when this account, the account in chapter 2 was given, to where we are now, about a 20-year time gap. And over that time, Nebuchadnezzar was not pleased with that answer. He did not want his kingdom to end. He wanted it to be an eternal kingdom. And so what we find here is he begins to build this statue of whatever it was, likely an image of himself, I would imagine, but we don't know that for sure. And his attempt in doing so was to make his kingdom eternal by deifying it. And you have to see that. We'll see that as we go through the story. It's going to get more specific in its information. This was not some political figurine. This was some deified figurine. Because in order for Nebuchadnezzar to make his kingdom last forever, he had to cross over into God's side of the equation. He would have to cross over somehow into a part which he knew he couldn't touch, but wanted to because he didn't want to let go of what he wanted. Does that ring a bell for anybody? Because truly, that's often what's happening in the lives of us, especially before we came to Jesus. And hopefully it came to an end at that point when we came to Jesus. But it certainly was the way that all of us walked prior to that. We know that God is God. We know that we're not God. Although many people would try to tell you that they are God. They have the Christ-likeness in them. They have some ability of God, a deification that they haven't understood yet. I've heard many accounts of this from people saying these very things to me. Prior to knowing Jesus, this is what I believed. It's what I understood. But it's simply not true. It's foolish. It's actually stupid if you think about it. That somehow we're going to take God off of his throne and put ourselves up on the throne so that we can determine how the world is going to be for us. It just doesn't work. And it doesn't work that way for anybody, but this is exactly what Nebuchadnezzar was going to do. So he sets up this giant image and demands that people will worship it, which basically would be worship to him, solidifying an eternal kingdom. It just wasn't ever going to happen. But it's still happening today. People do it in a much more sophisticated way. Maybe they do it in a very much more internal or self-centered way. But it's still happening. That's why this story does translate. Right off the bat, we can see that Nebuchadnezzar's fault is the same fault that many have. They still want to take the position of determining that they have the rightful rule as God in their own lives. And the truth is, we don't. What's interesting is that This is exactly what Satan does. And you're going to see several comparisons today of what Satan does when we line them up with Nebuchadnezzar. Keep looking for those examples because there is more to come from that. And although Satan knows that he cannot be God, the position is taken and God is not going to relinquish it to him. That's why he's so angry at you and I. Nonetheless, he is going to wage war against God. We talked about that last week. When the end of the tribulation period is over and Jesus returns and us with him, all the armies of the world, inspired by Satan, will go to war against God. And they know they can't win the war. They have to know. I mean, how could Satan not know at this particular point? He's been cast out of heaven. He is nowhere near where God stands in power, in position, in presence. And yet he's going to wage this war that he cannot win. Talk about stupid. It just gets dumber as we keep going through this. But don't we do the same? I mean, how often, even as believers, do we have these little events in our life where we just say, God, I don't like your outcome. I don't like the way that you've said that this will roll out. So I will wage war against that outcome. I will battle you in this piece because you didn't do what I wanted you to do. That doesn't turn out the way I wanted it to turn out. And guys, it's just as dumb as Satan taking on God here in that final battle in Revelation 19. But that's exactly what's happening as we move forward. You can't win the fight, but we still continue. Hopefully that's not true for us. Hopefully if that's ringing a bell for you and you're like, yeah, I got one of those fights I'm going on with God. Man, relinquish. He's going to win anyway. And he'd rather have you on the team than as an enemy. But you get to choose. Verse 2. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all of the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Catch that word set up. You're going to hear it several times, and I've already said it once or twice. Verse 3. So the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, the symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." How bizarre is it to worship an image that had to be created and couldn't even stand itself up? I mean, that's really what we're talking about here. Something that had to be created, but on its own could not stand. It took the will of this king to stand this silly thing up. And the only way that anybody would come to worship this thing was at the threat of death. It wasn't a devotion worship, it was a fear worship. If we don't worship this inanimate object that cannot stand itself up, the king who can will kill us. And what I find so interesting is that many today believe that that's exactly how God has dealt with us. I will talk with people trying to evangelize or share the word with them, and they'll say, yeah, I know God. He basically says, you can follow me or I'll kill you. And maybe you've heard that. Maybe you've been in those kind of conversations. And they would compare what Nebuchadnezzar has done with what God has done. And I'm going to tell you, it's exactly the opposite. For when God comes to us, do you know that we're already dead? We're already dead in sins and trespasses. What he's offering us isn't death if we don't worship him, but life if we do. It's a complete counter to what the world is offering. And I love that because the gospel is always a counter to what the world has to offer. And here it's about as clear as it can get. And I love that our Lord is in the position, not needing us to create him and stand him up, but that he created us and stood us up. Big difference. And the world can't see that because they're wearing blinders, but you and I can. In our free will, we can choose to come to that place where God can stand us up into newness of life and we can walk with him. But he gives us the freedom to choose. Nebuchadnezzar's threat was, if you don't worship, then I will kill you. Jesus says, you're dead, and if you do worship, I'll give you life. But I won't violate your free will in doing it. That's a huge difference. It's a huge difference. But again, what we see in Nebuchadnezzar here is the heart of Satan. That very same heart we just saw, it's being displayed again, and you're going to see it over and over. For during the time of the tribulation, Satan is also going to come into that rebuilt Jewish temple. And somewhere in that time, the false prophet who is going to cause people to worship the Antichrist or Satan is going to set up a statue. Revelation 13, verses 14 through 15. And that statue or that image will be given the ability to speak blasphemies. And whoever does not worship it will be what? Killed. What we see in Nebuchadnezzar is simply Satan working in his heart, the outworkings of the heart of Satan. And because they are, Nebuchadnezzar is choosing to follow Satan, maybe not knowingly. I'm sure not knowingly, believing he's following some other god. He is just simply doing what his god does. And he's operating the same way that Satan does. I think for us, you and I, we should constantly be looking at the way we're operating and say, who does that look more like? Does that look like our God or the God of this world? Is that the way my God would operate or the way the God of the world operates? Because if we would evaluate those things, I bet we'll find some parts where we go, man, I want to change this. I want to change this because it doesn't have the aroma of my king. Nebuchadnezzar simply following the one that he's followed all along. Verse 7. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, and the lyre in symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set up over the affairs of the province of Babylon, that was back in chapter 2, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Now, if you remember right, back in chapter 2, the king had called for all these same guys that he's listing here, including the Chaldeans, to come and tell him of a dream he had that was keeping him from sleeping, that was causing him great trouble. And he said, you need to tell me the dream and the interpretation. Well, they could not tell him the dream. And so the king decreed, all of you are going to die immediately. And he sent his soldiers out to wipe them all out. And along the way, they find Daniel. And Daniel says, hey, what's the rush? And they told him, and Daniel petitions the king. And then he goes and he gets some time. He prays. He goes back later and he tells the king of his dream and the interpretation. And guess what happens? The death sentence is stayed. It stopped at that particular point, including for the Chaldeans. These three men, plus Daniel, got together and prayed and received what they needed for life. And you would think that somehow in there they would say, oh my gosh, these guys, they saved us. They did for us what we could not do for ourselves through their God. And because of them, we're alive. 20 years later, apparently that is not in their memory. They can't draw that up. And so they're coming against now Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to kill them. And there's some pieces that you and I need to gather here. Because I tell you, they're missing in the church. They're very important principles about the reason why we serve in the world and show the love of Christ in the world and how we should do it and what our motive should be. Really important. You need to understand and believe that when we serve in the world, we should not expect that they will love us back. We need to understand that. Many people have gone out and serving and started out in missions work, either here locally or abroad, or started some project in their neighborhood. And when they've encountered resistance, even hostility from the very people that they've been serving, they pull back and say, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. They don't even appreciate me. They don't appreciate what I'm doing. They don't appreciate the effort that I have put forward. Do they not know the cost for us, what time I put in this and the money that I put in this? And that's the wrong attitude to go into the world with. It's the wrong approach completely. They're simply doing what the world does. The world uses one another for their stepping stones, for their own needs. I could go through a myriad of different ways we do that. We do it politically. We do it through finances. We do it for sexual gratification. It happens over and over and over again. It is the way that the world operates. It is the way that their God operates, and they simply follow His pattern. But we as believers, that's not why we serve. It's not why we come in and we show the love of Christ in the world. We show the love of Christ in the world that they might see Him in us and desire to be with Him also. That they might see the alternative to the world and say, man, that's what I want. So don't believe for a minute that you're going to get their undying gratitude. If that's the reason you serve, then you're going to be disappointed. Don't believe that for some reason they're going to find favor with you or see your church as the best place in the world to hang out. If they're from the world, the Lord told us they're at war with Him. They're at enmity with God. Now, they might come because what you are offering is attractive. And that's okay if that's the door opener to the gospel. But much of the church has stopped very short and just wants them to be friends with them. But that won't lead to salvation. And if that's our focus, is just to make them happy with us so that we can have favor with them. And they can have favor with us and we can all just get along.